This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of 11 previous books, including The Party's Over and The End of Growth. Richard Heinberg is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, published in 2015. Welcome, Richard.
It's good to be speaking with you again, Diane.
What is the purpose or goal of your book, Afterburn?
Well, it's to explore a range of issues surrounding the necessary and inevitable transition away from our reliance on fossil fuels to a renewable energy future. I say necessary and inevitable because there are two forces driving us toward a renewable energy future. One is obviously climate change, the fact that burning fossil fuels releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and is resulting in catastrophic climate change. We're seeing the beginnings of that now, but all of the responsible forecasts show that if we continue burning fossil fuels at current rates, things will get much, much worse as the century progresses. The other force driving us toward a renewable energy future is the fact that fossil fuels are, by definition, depleting non-renewable resources. And it's not as though we're about to run out of coal, oil, or natural gas, but we've extracted them using the low-hanging fruit principle. So we've gotten the best, easiest, cheapest of the fossil fuels first. And what's left is dirtier, harder to get, more expensive to produce fossil fuels. And we're seeing that especially now in the oil sector with the transition to unconventional oils like the tar sands of Alberta in Canada and the tight oil that's being produced by hydrofracturing here in the United States. As time goes on, these unconventional oils will make up a larger and larger percentage of the petroleum that we extract and use. And both the economic and the environmental price that we'll pay is very large. So we have to transition to a renewable energy future, but it's going to be a big deal, and that's what I hope to explore in the book.
In your book, you speak about the great burning. What is the great burning?
Well, you know, if we total up the combustion that occurs of fossil fuels on a daily basis around the world, it turns out to be an enormous amount. It's the equivalent annually of burning a quarter of the Amazon rainforest. Here, just in the United States, on an annual basis, we burn a quantity of fossil fuels that's equivalent in energy terms to all of the sunlight absorbed by all green plants, all forests, all crops, food crops, microscopic algae, everything on an annual basis. So obviously, we couldn't do that if we were just burning forests. We'd run out of forest. What enables us to burn so much is the fact that we're burning ancient sunlight from tens of millions of years ago in the form of fossil fuels. All of this combustion is completely unprecedented in Earth's history, but it occurs out of sight and out of mind in internal combustion engines and furnaces and so on. So we take it for granted. But our whole economy has come to depend upon this level of combustion, and we can't afford to take it for granted. It's something that is bizarre, unique to this historic moment, and it's something that can't continue.
Would you say more about the implications of the Great Burning?
Right. Well, the International Monetary Fund just came out with a report that discusses the environmental externalities of burning fossil fuels. Now, actually, the report says subsidies, but what they're really talking about are externalities. Externalities are impacts of an industrial process or an economic transaction that aren't priced into the goods and services traded. So, effectively, when we burn fossil fuels, the environmental costs are not paid for by the fossil fuel companies, typically, or even by the industries that are burning the fossil fuels. Society as a whole has to pick up the tab. And the IMF calculates that as about $10 million per minute of externalized costs related to fossil fuel combustion. Now, by calling these subsidies, they're actually fudging the situation a bit, because if it were just a subsidy like a tax break, well, we could cancel the subsidy and go on. You know, maybe we'd be paying a little bit more for our energy, but it would be easily solved. But these environmental externalities can't be done away with so easily. The only way to do that, actually, is to stop burning fossil fuels. And that's a little harder than it sounds, because fossil fuels are so implicated in everything we do. We are transitioning slowly. We're just beginning, really, to transition to renewable electricity in the form of wind and solar. But electricity is only 20% of the energy that we use globally and here in the U.S. The other four-fifths is in transportation, in industrial processes that often use high levels of heat, for example, making cement or making steel. These are going to be much more difficult to transition. And if we don't get started now, if we don't start at least thinking about how we're going to make steel or cement or live without these things in the future, then the inevitable energy transition of the 21st century is not going to go very easily.
In your book, you say that our future will be energy constrained. Would you explain?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult for us to replace fossil fuels with renewable sources of energy in such a way as to preserve all of the benefits that we're currently getting from coal, oil, and natural gas. After all, these substances were created not by human beings, but by nature over, again, tens of millions of years. To replicate the benefits of fossil fuels with energy captured from ambient sources like wind and sunlight in real time, that's a pretty optimistic project. Of course, wind and sun are free, and that's one thing in their favor. Of course, the other thing is that they don't entail the pollution and climate change that are entailed by burning fossil fuels. But the devices that we use to capture wind and solar energy are not renewable. They're built using high heat industrial processes that are currently fed by fossil fuels. And so when you look at the energy transition from a systemic perspective and take into account not only the uniqueness of fossil fuels, but also the necessity of using fossil fuels to build out the renewable replacement infrastructure, it seems very far-fetched that we'll be able to recreate the kinds of consumer growth society that we've enjoyed for the past few decades. I put enjoyed in quotation marks, by the way, using renewable energy sources.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of the book Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you predict a transformation of society's infrastructure that will take place as we transition away from fossil fuels. How will the infrastructure change?
Currently, our infrastructure is all about fossil fuels. For example, our transport infrastructure was built around the automobile, the truck, the airplane. These are inherently energy inefficient modes of transport, and at least one of them is going to be almost impossible to transition to electricity, and that's, of course, the airplane. We're not going to have battery-powered airliners carrying hundreds of people at a time from one side of the world to the other, because batteries, even the most futuristic batteries that are on the drawing boards, have much too low of an energy density to enable the plane to get off the ground, energy density being the amount of energy that can be stored per kilogram or per liter. The reason planes run on oil is that it's highly concentrated and portable. Same thing with automobiles and trucks. Now, we can have electric cars. They're small enough so that the batteries can be of a modest enough size to be transportable. But when you get to 18-wheel trucks and ships, it becomes much more difficult. Of course, ships are responsible for carrying 90% of global trade goods. So all of this becomes very problematic. We could have big kites and sails to help ships move with less in the way of fossil fuels propelling them. But it's only an energy efficiency measure. And of course, if you use kites and sails, then you're subject to doldrums. And everything becomes more complicated and slower. Building highways requires cement and steel, which we talked about just a few moments before. That's going to be problematic in a world where we don't have coal and natural gas to fire blast furnaces and cement kilns. So our infrastructure is going to change pretty profoundly during our transition to a renewable energy future. And if we plan for that, if we get off of motorized transport and get back on our feet, on bicycles and so on, if we relocalize our communities, it won't be so bad. In fact, we could enjoy a lot of benefits from the transition. But if we assume the future is going to be more flying cars and personal submarines and all of these technological marvels, I think we're in for some disappointments.
How will society be different with a different energy infrastructure?
Well, in all the ways we've been talking about, and lots more, and one of the ways that's really going to be important is our economy. You know, we've built over the past few decades a growth-based economy, a consumer economy. And in the book, I have a chapter that actually talks about where the consumer economy came from. It happened as a result of cheap energy. Back in the early 20th century, we had so much cheap fossil energy. And we could make so much stuff with that energy, with our new inventions like powered assembly lines, that our biggest economic problem was overproduction. Our solution to that was twofold. First, the advertising industry. We found ways to talk people into wanting and buying more stuff than they realized that they needed. And then the other solution was consumer credit. We made it easier for people to go into debt so they could consume now and pay later. So these two things, the advertising industry and consumer credit, really transformed the economy from the inside out. And it became a consumer economy where 70% of the economy depends upon people going out and buying manufactured goods. And at this point, it's systemic. Consumerism isn't just a state of mind. It's not just a sort of greedy attitude that some people have. It's a way of organizing the overall economy. And that way of organizing the economy worked after a fashion during the 20th century with cheap, abundant energy. But it's not going to work so well in the 21st century. And in fact, it's starting to break down already as a result of demographic factors, economic trends like increasing economic inequality, and also as the energy transition happens, it's going to be much more difficult to maintain consumerism as a way of life and as a way of managing an economy.
Would you say more about why society is likely to become more local as we transition to a new energy future?
It all has to do with cheap, abundant transport energy, which is what we had during the 20th century. And with cheap transport energy, it made sense for people to commute long distances from where housing was cheap to where jobs were available. It made sense to globalize the economy so that corporations could search out the cheapest labor anywhere on the planet. But that doesn't make so much sense as oil becomes more scarce and expensive. And by the way, oil prices have fallen in the last few months, but they're still at historically relatively high levels, and the problem hasn't gone away. We're just seeing it masked temporarily by a very short-term spike in production of U.S. tight oil that's occurred as a result, again, of hydrofracturing horizontal drilling. But tight oil is going away. It only works with very high oil prices, such as we had between 2010 and 2014. When oil prices rise again, as they inevitably will, if the industry is going to remain profitable, then that's going to have an impact on the rest of society, because high oil prices are like sand in the gears of the industrial system. So we can no longer have both cheap and abundant oil. If we're going to have enough oil, it's going to be expensive oil. And if we're going to have cheap oil, we're not going to have very much of it. So this is a fundamental change in our global economic system, and it's going to result gradually over time in the reversal of the trend of globalization, because the transport fuel simply won't be there to enable it to happen.
Would you say more about the social implications of a new energy future?
Yeah, well, the biggest demographic trends of the 20th century really had a lot to do with cheap energy. One of them was urbanization. As we had more and more cheap oil with which to replace farm labor with machines, that freed up millions upon hundreds of millions of people then to go from farms to cities to look for work. And as industrial manufacturing expanded, again with cheap energy, there were lots of jobs for all those people. So that created the middle class, and that's the second big demographic trend of the 20th century. So urbanization and the creation of middle class were very closely tied to the availability of cheap, abundant energy. As energy gets different, as we move to renewable sources of energy and we have less energy but with different characteristics, we're going to see very different demographic trends. And I think one of those trends is going to be de-urbanization or re-ruralization. People are going to have to be located more in areas where food is being produced because it's going to take more human labor to produce food. Now, I'm not suggesting the end of the 21st century will look a lot like the beginning of the 19th century. We've developed a lot of technologies, a lot of science in the meantime that could enable us to produce food and other materials from row crops in ways that are much more efficient and much more labor-friendly than was the case in the old days. But nevertheless, we are going to need more people paying attention to real productive activities, making stuff with their hands, rather than just sitting at desks and punching buttons all day. And again, this could be very good for us. You know, they say sitting is the new smoking, and our urban lifestyles are in many ways not so good for us, and we could benefit from the revitalization of small towns and meaningful professions that involve manual work. But that transition will go better if we understand that that's where we're going and we plan for it.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of the book, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. In one of the chapters in your book, you speak about a public relations problem in regard to persuading policymakers and the public to do what is needed to address climate change. What do you see as a public relations problem?
It's simply this. If they're going to tell the truth about climate change, our political leaders need to grasp and convey the enormity of the adaptive challenge ahead of us. And they're loath to do that, because that adaptive challenge really centers on the one priority of every policymaker worldwide, and that is economic growth. Economic growth is not something that we've always had. It really began in the sense that we think of it today during the mid-20th century, again during a time of cheap, abundant fossil energy. And mathematicians understand that growth is something that can't occur forever within a finite bounded system. Even 1% growth entails a doubling of a given quantity every 70 years. So if our global population were to continue growing at 1% per year, we have 7.3 billion people today. In 70 years, we'd have 15 billion. 70 years after that, 30 billion. 70 years after that, 60 billion. And it doesn't take all that many doublings before you get to a really absurd situation where, you know, you have to have people standing on each other's shoulders because there's no more room for them all. The same thing with an increase in global consumption of resources. A 1% annual increase in consumption rates is pretty modest by recent historic standards, but it's completely unsustainable over the long term. Well, we've sort of hidden that unsustainability of growth away from ourselves, and growth has become the be-all and end-all of government policy. So we've been pursuing an impossible goal, namely perpetual economic growth, for the last number of years, and the impossibility of that goal is starting to catch up with us. And this is especially going to be true as we begin to deal with climate change, because the speed at which we're going to have to reduce our burning of fossil fuels is such that it's going to be almost impossible for us to maintain the same level of energy consumption that we are used to, as we discussed earlier. And energy is what makes the economy go. It's not just a component of GDP. In fact, the entire economy depends upon energy in every detail. If the gas pumps go dry, if the power goes off, the economy doesn't contract by 10% because we spend 10% of GDP on energy. The economy goes away. So as the energy system changes in our transition away from fossil fuels, that's going to have profound economic impact, and policymakers don't like to think about that, nor do they like to talk about it to their constituency. So we're between a rock and a hard place. We have this real impact bearing down upon us from climate change. But what we have to do about climate change is something that nobody wants to recognize or talk about.
How do you suggest the climate change discussion be reframed?
Well, I think one thing that would help is if everyone understood that even though burning fossil fuels is the only way we're going to be able to maintain the kind of economic growth that we've had over the past several decades, if everyone understood that that's not a viable option, not only from an environmental perspective, but also from an economic standpoint, I think that would really help. If folks really understood the low-hanging fruit phenomenon, the fact that with every passing year, our fossil fuel energy system becomes less and less economically viable, I think that would help them understand that we are going to have to make these kinds of sacrifices. So it's just a question of whether we make them voluntarily and in a planned way, or watch as our economy begins to come apart at the seams as a result of resource depletion and the decreasing viability of our energy economy. So if we plan for the transition, what we would do in that case is devote an increasing proportion of continuing fossil fuel use to the production of our renewable energy future infrastructure. And that future infrastructure, of course, will include solar panels and wind turbines, but it will also include different ways of producing the stuff that we need, different ways of living, houses that don't require energy for heating and air conditioning, modes of transport that are inherently much more energy efficient than cars and trucks and airplanes. All of that's going to take time, and it's also going to take energy. And where's that energy going to come from? Well, it's going to have to come from the remaining fossil fuels that we continue burning. So we can't afford to continue burning those fossil fuels in all the frivolous ways that we do today, driving enormous personal vehicles and in a consumer economy that produces vast amounts of waste that we simply don't know what to do with.
Well, you've alluded a bit to this, but what do you suggest is the best approach to adaptation in a new energy future?
It's not an easy question. You know, I think if we simply let the market adapt to the depletion of fossil fuels, then we'll have a very dysfunctional transition. And what we'll be transitioning to will be a future that none of us would like to see. If we're going to have a successful transition to a renewable energy future, it is, as I've said, going to take some planning and conscious adaptation. I think there has to be a role for government there. And unfortunately, right now, government doesn't really seem up to it, especially national levels of government. Often where we are seeing the most proactive steps to adapt to a renewable energy future is at the local levels of government, cities, towns, counties in some cases, in a few cases states, are getting out way ahead of the federal government in terms of renewable energy policies, in terms of energy efficiency policies, in terms of subsidizing high-speed rail or expanding rail networks. Rail, by the way, is far more energy efficient than moving goods around by truck or airplane. So we're going to have to start where there is receptivity, and that means mostly at the local level, and then push these policies increasingly to the federal and national level until we finally get a unified and coherent vision and policy of transition beyond our fossil-fueled economy of the 20th century to a true renewable energy economy of the 21st century.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
We are faced with enormous challenges this century, but those are also enormous creative opportunities. When young people grow up in the world, they naturally want to contribute to the world and change the world. Well, what a set of opportunities, because all of the institutions of our society currently are going to require transformation over the course of the next few decades. We need young people with understanding of systems, knowledge of how to change systems, and the vision and burning desire to want to change these systems so that they are appropriate to a renewable energy economy, and so that they're durable over the long run, so that we can have something like a sustainable civilization. That's never existed in the Earth's past before. All of our previous civilizations have been pretty flimsy and have collapsed in relatively short order. Unless we're going to experience the same thing, we need to think this thing through better. And what a challenge for young people. So it's a difficult time to be alive, but it's also a time of extraordinary, unprecedented opportunity.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Richard.
It's been a pleasure, Diane. I've enjoyed talking with you.
You were just listening to Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of the book, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, published in 2015 by New Society Publishers. For more information, check on the web at richardheinberg.com. That's richardheinberg.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.